This evening we're going to actually start in chapter 2. As we said when we were introducing our study, the language switches from Hebrew to Babylonian or Chaldean right in the middle of verse 4. So the Hebrew from chapter 1, verse 1 goes down through chapter 2 and then into verse 4 to the middle. And when it says the Chaldeans spoke to the king in Aramaic, "O King, live forever," is written in Aramaic, which is Chaldean or Babylonian. They use the same alphabet. It's just like English and Spanish and French. We use the same alphabet, but it's not the same language. So if you were to look at it without understanding the difference, if you were to look at it, it would look like the Hebrew continues because it's the same letters and all that. But it's actually switching to a new language. The King James called it Syriac, and the 1901 ASV called it the Syrian language, but all that is a reference to the fact that the land of Syria now was part at that time of the Babylonian Empire. So the language of the Chaldeans was Aramaic, and that's when he started writing, and it goes all the way from chapter 2, verse 4, all the way through chapter 7. So we're moving into the area where God is actually addressing the Gentiles, the Babylonians. This is information that's for everybody, but it's specifically for the Babylonians. And the message is, as we said earlier, set up in a chiastic structure, so we know really what the point is. The point is chapters 4 and 5, where the arrogance of these two Babylonian kings is confronted, one with mercy. I'm not sure that Nebuchadnezzar thought it was merciful to think he was a beast of the field for 7 years, but out of it came true recognition. And then, of course, chapter 5 is the handwriting on the wall and the declaration that you're dead tonight. So that's where we're headed. We're going into chapter 2. Which is in the chiastic structure parallel to chapter 7. So when we get to chapter 7, we'll be going back over some of the major issues that are in chapter 2. It's just a different kind of vision, different particulars, but the same interpretation is given. So that's where we're headed. So I wanted to start this evening with verse 1 of chapter 2. This is his introduction into the material that's in chapter 2, which is extremely crucial. But it says, in the second year of the reign of Nebuchadnezzar, Nebuchadnezzar had dreams, and his spirit was troubled, and his sleep left him. One of the things that you run into immediately in verse 1 is that the second year business, because we've already covered 3 years. Daniel and Hananiah and Mishael and Azariah were educated by the king's command for 3 years. And they're involved in this because when the king says, kill them all, that includes Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. So this is after the 3 years, and yet it's staged in the second year. And, of course, the liberals, they don't like the book of Daniel. They despise the book of Daniel because it forces them to recognize that there is such a thing as legitimate prophecy. I mean, it doesn't force them because they don't recognize it, but if they were paying attention, it'd force it. Ever since the discovery of the Dead Sea Scrolls, 1948, because that was when it was demonstrated by just the Dead Sea Scrolls that Daniel had been written back when they said it was, and the liberals had up till that point argued that it was written after the period of the Maccabees when all these prophecies had actually been fulfilled already. And because they said there's no such thing as prophecy. Well, anyway, they jump on this second year of the reign of Nebuchadnezzar and they say this is a contradiction from chapter 1 and it's obviously an error. And when I read that kind of stuff, I just think, how absolutely blind and foolish is a person to make that kind of assumption. Daniel and his companions were already serving in the king's government. They'd already had their 3 years of what I call attempted brainwashing or their education in all things Babylonian. And for Daniel to date this chapter's events in the second year, as I said in B here, gives those who hate this book an opening to argue for a flaw. But the whole idea that this is a flaw is rooted in about three assumptions, and they're just ludicrous. The first assumption is that Daniel was too stupid to realize he'd made a huge mistake in his chronology. Here's Daniel writing the book of Daniel. He's the one that wrote chapter 1, said that they were trained for 3 years and put in service to the king. He's the one that wrote right after that, that it was in the second year of the reign of Nebuchadnezzar that this dreams came into play. So, I mean, for an author to do that, it's ludicrous to assume that he was so dumb that he didn't even realize he'd made this mistake. It's a whole lot more reasonable to think that Daniel had a reason for saying it that way than it is to think that he just didn't understand his own chronology. The second thing that's in this assumption thing is that calling Nebuchadnezzar the king in chapter 1, verse 1 was also an error. Because if this was the second year, it was the fourth year that the hostages had been in Babylon. So if this is the second year, well then Nebuchadnezzar wasn't the king 4 years prior, because this is the second year. So that means that in chapter 1, verse 1, when he said Nebuchadnezzar the king came and besieged Jerusalem, that's another mistake. And
I wonder if the same author would go to Genesis and say the same thing when you go from 1 to 3.
Oh, they do it all the time. They're finding errors all the time. Contradictions, they call them.
Yeah.
Flaws. Mistakes. But there's also a third assumption, and that is that Daniel, having been trained for 3 years in all things Babylonian, would not be fully cognizant or aware of the king's identity and the details of his rule. I mean, they're assuming that he didn't know this stuff. But he's just been trained for 3 years and all this stuff. And besides that, he just came off of an interview with the king where the king found him 10 times smarter than all the other guys. So, those are the assumptions. And now I'm just going to call them ludicrous. They're ludicrous. They're excuses to not be willing to believe the evidence. And that's the first place in our carnal mind that is at war with God. There is this powerful reluctance to let the Word of God mean what it says. I mean, I've even had in our day, in this country, we're so far gone that the transgender, I'm going to get in big trouble now, but I'm going to say it anyway, all of this sexual immorality that is being promoted as okay, and not just okay, but to be encouraged. All that kind of stuff. Somebody says, well, what about Sodom and Gomorrah? God destroyed Sodom and Gomorrah because they were homosexual. Oh, no, that's not why he did it. He did it because they were inhospitable. These two guys came into town and they didn't want to show them hospitality, and that made God angry. I mean, the excuses that people give so that they don't have to accept what the Scriptures declare are just amazing. And this is where this comes from. So let's just think about the indisputable facts. This book, the book of Daniel, was written by Daniel in its totality more than 70 years later in time than the events that he's recording here, so that when he was writing it 70 years later, he was using the 70 years later setting and the language reflecting it. And that's not to say that he didn't record the details along the way, along these years that he was spending in Babylon. He probably made meticulous records of the stuff that he's now writing out in a formal presentation, because we know it's a formal presentation because he jumps from the second year to here to the last year to there, and he's all over the time chronologically, so we know he put it together on purpose in a non-chronological way, that is to say in a thematic way so that he could get his point across. And given that reality, the fact that he wrote it 70 years later, put it in its form 70 years later, would automatically allow him to say things that were true, but they might not have been technically accurate to the time. For example, if I say President Eisenhower was the key general in the Second World War in the European theater. Am I lying? He wasn't president when he was the chief general in the theater. I said the president. No. I'm just identifying him after all these years. Everybody knows he was the president. So the fact that I call him President Eisenhower and then refer to something that happened before he was president doesn't mean that, that's not an error. It's not even a misleading statement. It's just a fact. And we do this constantly. Whenever we're talking about somebody who has a high visibility identity, we will use that high visibility identity to let people know who we're talking about, and then we'll talk about something that, well, for example, President Obama wrote something about my father, something or another. It was a book that he was supposed to have written before he became president. But I said President Obama wrote it. All I'm saying is we talk like this all the time. We take the identity of the individual that everybody knows about, and then we tell something that he did. And that's exactly what's going on in chapter 1 when he says King Nebuchadnezzar came. The real historical fact is that Nabonidus was Nebuchadnezzar's father, and he was technically the king of Babylon. But he was in serious ill health and had delegated an enormous amount of the rule over Babylon to Nebuchadnezzar, his son. And that meant that he was, in a sense, Nebuchadnezzar was a co-regent. They were both kings ruling together because the daddy was the technical king and then he was delegating responsibility to Nebuchadnezzar. So when we get to chapter 2, verse 1, and it says, in the second year, all that means is that Nabonidus died 2 years ago. Nebuchadnezzar is now the entrenched king. He's the one who has solidified his rule after the death of his father. And what happened in this second year was that he began to have some dreams that gave him insomnia. He couldn't sleep. And the dream, the word dreams is plural. But in the rest of the story, there's only one dream, which meant he was having the same dream several times. He'd go to sleep and he'd wake up because his dream woke him up. And so he'd drift off to sleep and then he'd wake up again because he was going back to the same dream. This thing was important. And the thing that's significant about it is that he knew it was important. Because when you read verses 1 through 13 of chapter 2, you find out real quick that Nebuchadnezzar was desperate to find out what this dream meant. He was so desperate to find out that he wanted to make absolutely sure he got the right interpretation.
Were the Babylonians real stringent in astrology and different things? So they
look at whom he called. He said he called the magicians, the conjurers, the sorcerers, and the Chaldeans. Well, the word translated conjurers is also translated astrologers. So you have these magicians, you have these astrologers, you have the sorcerers, and then you have the Chaldeans as a class of wise men in the group. Those are the people he called because he wanted to know what this dream meant.
And weren't they, didn't they have a reputation of kingmakers? And that's the, you know, those who came from Christ's birth.
You mean the Magi?
The Magi?
They may have been from Babylon. It's a very real possibility because Babylon was real big into astrology. And I'm not talking about astrology the way it is in 20th century world. Astrology for them was like astronomy is for us. They studied the heavens. They studied the movement of the stars. And then they began to assign significance to all that. And that's what astrology is. When you try to decide what it means that Jupiter and Virgo are in the same house in the heavens at this particular time. The brilliance of the light as they come together. You try to figure out what that means. Well, the Magi that came to Jerusalem at the birth of Christ, they were dead right.
They knew
whether they knew the scriptures or not, And they may have, because Daniel's influence in Babylon may have had a residual impact, especially in the educated wise men class, because Daniel was a well-known guy at that time. But the fact is, they were dead right. When King asked the students of the scriptures, where's Christ going to be born? They said, Bethlehem. He said, well, go to Bethlehem then, and when you find him, come tell me so I can come worship him too.
And that's why he was so afraid, because he knew that they knew what they were talking about.
Well, it's a real possibility, because
they didn't want to know another king but him.
And his behavior is exactly like Nebuchadnezzar's in chapter 3. We'll get to that later, but the point is, after Nabonidus died, Nebuchadnezzar solidified his authority in the kingdom, and he began to have these dreams. And the fact is that when you look at the people that he has drew together, the magicians and astrologers and sorcerers and Chaldeans, there's an interesting omission there, because he didn't call Daniel and Hananiah and Mishael and Azariah. They weren't there. When the decree went out in verse 12 and 13 to kill all the wise men, it says that they looked for Daniel and his friends to kill him, which means they weren't handy. They had to go find him. And then Daniel had to ask Arioch, the captain of the king's guard, in verse 14, we're out of our paragraph here, but when he had to ask him, what's going on? How come you're out here to kill me? And then Arioch filled him in. Well, that means he wasn't there. Which means, probably, that the events of chapter 1 were too fresh. Daniel and Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, or Belshazzar, whatever their other name is. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Well, I don't like the fact that they tried to brainwash them, change their name to worshiping false gods. But anyway. The fact is, they had been put into the king's service, but apparently they hadn't been immersed in it yet, because they hadn't gotten into any positions of responsibility, because they weren't even there when the king called these guys together. So, this is a real recent follow-up of chapter 1 after they had entered the king's service. That brings us then to the real issues in verses 1 to 13, and that is the focus of attention. Because the king says in verse 3, I had a dream, and his spirit is anxious to understand the dream. Well, that means that the dreams in verse 1 and the dream are the same thing. He's just talking about the fact that I've been bugged a lot about this. Yeah, and it's, I need to know what the dream signifies. And this was, it had its roots even in Pharaoh with Joseph. Because Joseph had been given the ability to interpret dreams. And if you'll remember that Daniel, according to verse 17 of chapter 1, understood visions and dreams. Which is just a prelude statement so that chapter 2 makes sense. Well, here in the story, the king is telling the people that he has been somewhat dependent on, because the dream is so potent in terms of its implications. He senses that there's something really significant about this, and it's repeated so that he deeply felt like that there were some things he needed to know. So he calls these four categories of the wise, and they say to the king in response to his statement, O king, live forever, you know. Tell the dream to your servants and we'll declare the interpretation. That's the expected response. You've had a dream, you want to know what it means? Tell me what you dreamed, I'll tell you what it means. But the problem is, of course, that the king knows that he and they are all liars. He says, the command from me is firm. If you don't make known to me the dream and its interpretation, you will be torn limb from limb and your houses will be made a rubbish heap. But if you declare the dream and its interpretation, you'll receive from me gifts and reward and great honor. Therefore, declare to me the dream and its interpretation. And they said, well, in the King James, and I was looking for the statement, in the King James it says, you know that the dream has gone from me. Anyway, wherever I got that idea, I don't see it in the text now, so we'll skip it. The point, though, is that the king created a subterfuge. He wants a viable answer. He wants the truth. And the wise men tell him, if you'll tell us what you dream, we'll tell you what it means. They said that in verse 4. And then they said in verse 7, let the king tell the dream to his servants and we'll declare the interpretation. So this whole business is, the king wants an interpretation he can trust. But he knows these guys. They're his cadre of advisors. He knows them. And he knows, I don't know how much he knows about himself, but they know he's a megalomaniac, and you don't contradict him or you tell him what he wants to hear. And he knows that they'll just come up with something. So he just decides that the only way he can be sure that they know what they're talking about is if they can tell him what he dreamed and what it means. And, of course, they're just absolutely... The issue here in verse 5, if you don't make known to me the dream and its interpretation, you'll be torn limb from limb. They actually used to do that to people. They would hook four teams of horses, two to each leg, two to each arm, and go in four different directions simultaneously. And they just tear people apart that way. That's what he meant, torn limb from limb. And then, of course, they wouldn't worry about having their houses made of rubbish heap because they wouldn't be around to know it. But nonetheless, this is a horrifying prognosis of what's going to happen to you if you don't tell me what I dreamed and what it means. And the king knows that they're highly motivated by one of two things. One of them is a potent, fearsome death, and the other is a lust for outsized reward, because he said, if you can declare the dream and the interpretation, you'll get gifts and reward and great honor. Well, they all wanted that. So it's the carrot stick approach. Don't do it and you get the stick. Do it and you get the carrot. But the problem is, in the context, this whole thing is, they say to him in verse 7, let the king tell the dream and we'll declare the interpretation. He says, I know for certain that you're just bargaining for time. Oh, here it is. Inasmuch as you have seen that the command from me is firm. That I thought it meant you've seen that the thing has gone from me. Is that what it said in verse 8 of the King James on the front page there? Yeah, because you see the thing has gone from me. Well, the New American Standard translates that, the command from me is firm. But the King James understood that to mean, I told you I couldn't remember it. Well, now, just how much sense does that make? The guy has this dream over and over and over. He can't sleep because of it. And he tells him, I can't remember it. So.
How will he know if it is when they tell
him? Exactly. So, he says, if you don't make the dream known to me, verse 9, there is only one decree for you. You have agreed together to speak lying and corrupt words before me until the situation is changed. Therefore, tell me the dream, that I may know that you can declare to me its interpretation. So he doubles down on this demand. You have to tell me what I dreamed and what it means. And notice what they say. Verse 10, there's not a man on earth who could declare the matter for the king. And they should have just shut up right then. But they had to go on and say, inasmuch as no great king or ruler has ever asked anything like this of a magician, conjurer, or Chaldean, the thing the king demands is difficult, and there's no one who could declare it to the king except gods, whose dwelling place is not with mortal flesh. Well, you don't talk like that to an egomaniac, because they're basically saying, you don't have any business asking us this. Nobody, no great king would do that. Pretty well sealing their doom. But the point of it is that all of the wise men and the king realize that there is something profoundly significant about this issue. And you remember when we were talking in chapter 1 about how they defined their gods in terms of power, especially in military conquest? And I told you that was a big mistake. And it proves out to be a big mistake in the book of Revelation. Because the false prophet can call fire down from heaven, which is an Elijah miracle, an exercise of power. The Antichrist can recover from a mortal wound to his neck or head. He's able to make an image of him speak, or at least appear to. So defining God in terms of power is a mistake. Even in Joseph's experience in the Pharaoh's court, sometimes the stuff he did, the magicians and astrologers would be able to mimic. But he got to a certain point and they said, this is the finger of God. Well, my point in this whole thing is that Daniel is the most specific prophetic book in the Bible in terms of the detail of prophecy that's given. When I first started studying Daniel to teach it the very first time, I studied it with a set of encyclopedias beside me. And when it would mention somebody, I'd look them up in the encyclopedia and I'd read the prophecy and I'd read what the encyclopedia said. It's the same basic stuff. And that's the accuracy. That's the reason why the liberals hated this book. Because the accuracy is obvious. The clarity of the prophecies and the fulfillment is indisputable. So they would just say, well, it had to be written after the fact then. But the point here is that Daniel is going to capitalize on this statement that the Chaldeans make. Because they say, there's nobody that could do this except the gods. In other words, there's only a select type of individual who could give you your dream and the interpretation, and that would be a god, an Elohim. Well, that is the core issue in all of the book of Daniel and all of the Bible. Because the first issue in dealing with the issue of God is defining which God is the true one. That's the problem. Even in our world today, that's the problem. When our presidents and even Billy Graham at the memorial service for the 9/11 thing way back when, I was listening to President Bush and Billy Graham both said that Allah and our God are the same person. That they were worshiping the same God we were worshiping. And I thought to myself, oh, I didn't hear you say that. I could understand President Bush saying that, because after all, he was a Methodist. No slam intended, but I was raised Methodist, and I never heard the truth that I know of in that setting. But nonetheless, I could not believe that Billy Graham would say that. Because there's a crucial issue in all of the first part of the beginning of life is the fear of the right Lord. The fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. Well, that's Yahweh. And if you're worshiping Buddha, or you're a Taoist, or a Shinto, or a Muslim, or any deity that is put forth that isn't the God of the Scriptures, will not get you to life, because it's your concept of God that enables you to believe whoever it is you're worshiping. It's your concept of Him is the foundations for your faith. And without faith, it's impossible to please the true God, which means you got to know who He is in terms of all the competitors. And then you got to know what He has said so you can believe Him. Well, if that's the case, and it is the case, the opening salvo by Daniel for the Babylonians, the material in chapters 2 through 7, the opening salvo is going to be the king himself put forward a problem that only the God of heaven could have the answer to, and the Chaldeans and the astrologers and the sorcerers and the magicians know it. So they then accuse Nebuchadnezzar in verse 11 of going beyond his rights as a king to demand this of them. But like I said, the king is a liar, and they are liars, and he knows them, and they know him. They know he's an egomaniac, and if they say the wrong thing, they're going to get it in the neck, but they figure they're going to get torn limb from limb anyway, unless they can talk him into telling what he dreams so they can come up with some cockamamie explanation. And so they really don't have anything to lose, except that you really shouldn't insult an egomaniac. That just makes him mad. Because verse 12 says, the king became indignant, very furious, and gave orders to destroy all the wise men of Babylon. Now that is one angry man. And his anger is probably rooted in the insult that they gave him in verse 10 and 11. But it's also in the frustration of having this dream that he can't find an answer to. He knows it's significant, but he can't find anybody to give him a legitimate or viable explanation. He's not about to tell him what he dreamed, because then they'll come up with some kind of an explanation. So he's angry. He's really angry. And he decides that he can do without all these guys. Going to kill them all. And so the decree goes out that the wise men should be slain, and they look for Daniel and his friends to kill them. Well, that's as far as we're going to go in terms of the text, but I want you to think about the problem that Daniel and his friends are being presented with here, because they're under a decree of death. This is the second time, chapter 1, when they couldn't eat the king's provided food, the prince of the eunuchs said to them, "You're making me put my neck at risk here. He'll kill me if I don't do what he told me to do with you," which implies also that they're subject to the same threat of death. So, chapter 1, they're under the threat of death. Chapter 2, they're under the threat of death. Chapter 3, they're under the threat of death. So, this has got to be understood in light of Habakkuk's promise that he had gotten from God. Because remember, Habakkuk wrote the book of Habakkuk just a year or two before the king came to Jerusalem and took Daniel and his friends out. It's 5 or 6 years now from that time that Habakkuk wrote his book. But in the second chapter there, "the just by faith shall live" is the promise that God has made. Believe it or don't believe it. That's what I mean. That's what I said. That's what I mean. Okay? This is the second time that this specter of death is hanging over the faithful. And he's got a fiery, sudden temper. And it's also, as we're going to see in the weeks to come, the second time that Daniel uses his diplomatic skills to address it. Because he says to Arioch, "What's the big rush here?" "Well, the king has said we have to kill you." "Well, wait a minute, let me go see the king." And he asked the king for 24 hours. The king's got nothing to lose.